loved him very much. I could also imagine that there were moments when he thought, "Dear Christ, all this political shit, living with this beautiful woman is much nicer." The atmosphere in the propaganda ministry was the same as in the whole country, but it would soon worsen. Things went into decline, especially supplies, and everything got very much worse. Stalingrad had changed everything. The loss of the army. We sensed that in the ministry, too. For the first months, it was wonderful there, and after my initial doubts, I liked it very much. Oh, the coming and going, the beautiful furniture, the nice people. But then everything collapsed. The whole atmosphere changed. Stalingrad was played down. They tried to present it as a mere trifle, but they didn't succeed. Then the war really got going. From then on, Goebbels was in the Promi a lot, limping through his office. He couldn't hide the limp. That was a time when you couldn't do as much as you can now. Today they would sort it out in some way so that you didn't notice it, but it was impossible to ignore. He limped in, and his suit could be as smart as you like and as well-fitting, but he limped, and that made you feel a bit sorry for him. He made up for it all with incredible arrogance and self-confidence. Before, he was often shown in early pictures when he was canvassing for Hitler with other people on trucks and things with a cap. He looked dreadful. Now, he was always a gentleman when he came into the office. Because sometimes there were people with him, you can imagine they had some pretty tough discussions. Once I remember us all saying, "He really shouted today," when he had shouted at somebody or other. We all thought that was incredible. Never again. Just that one time, he was a man who had, what do you say, composure, self-control. There were also comical moments. Someone had thought of sending Goebbels' dog to him in Venice. Goebbels had gone to Venice Biennale with his wife and stayed there for a few days. Someone had probably got word that Goebbels had said it would be nice if his dog were there too. So some eager staff member called us to say that Herr Minister wanted to have his dog in Venice. We said, "Are they mad? Sending a dog on a plane to the Biennale in Venice? As if they have nothing else to worry about in the middle of the war." So we thought it was infuriating. Someone was given the task of going to Tempelhof Airport and ensuring that the dog would fly to Venice, but accompanied by somebody with the dog as hand luggage. Some chief of press was flying to Venice every day anyway, taking the latest foreign news so that Herr Minister could keep up to date. That was Herr von Schirmmeister. Another assistant, Schirmmeister, was told, "If you fly tomorrow, take the dog with you to Goebbels. Herr Minister would like to have his dog there." "Never," Schirmmeister said. "I will never do anything like that." He was a slightly older, sensitive gentleman who thought this was an infuriating presumption. It was no good. They handed the poor chap the dog at the airport, and he flew with the dog to Venice. But there he was received with the greatest displeasure. I think Goebbels himself was furious. What idiot had come up with the idea of flying that oversensitive, nervous animal all the way there? He was a shy animal. In fact, he was big and beautiful, but if you took a step toward him, he always flinched. He had been spoiled somehow. So the dog was sent back, and that was all in the third year of the war. So there was an almighty to-do from Goebbels. We thought that was a wonderful story. We laughed our heads off. I discovered his true nature only very slowly. I remember the famous event at the Sportpalast. "Do you want total war?" We knew Goebbels was delivering a speech that afternoon. At that time, all events had been moved to the afternoon because the sirens went off every evening at 6:30, whether planes came or not. They almost always did. It was very rarely a false alarm. There were no evening events anymore. There were no theater performances, no films in the cinema. Everything was moved to the afternoon. So Herr Goebbels was to give a speech in the Sportpalast, and suddenly they were saying that two ladies from the outer office were to come to the Sportpalast too. Why? I don't know. They just want two to come. Who? We all looked at each other, and no one volunteered. Frau Krüger was the oldest, so she didn't need to, and it fell to me and a young girl. An SS man came and put us in an elegant Mercedes. That was a lovely start. And he drove us to the Sportpalast. It was on Potsdamer Straße, and he took us to one of the rows of seats. Really good seats, very near the speaker's podium. The hall was already full of workers who had been drummed up. For these events, if people in the factories were called on, who wants to go? At first everyone ducked out. At around this time, certainly, no one volunteered. They were mostly chosen. So they were dragged out of the plants and factories to take part in this announcement in the Sportpalast. I still remember the actor Heinrich George, the father of Götz George, sitting in the third row at the front. And as soon as they were there, it got going. Frau Goebbels was sitting behind us with two children, and SS men sat next to us. We really were in an elite position, I would say. The marching bands came in with the usual military marching music and singing and everything else that went with it. Then Goebbels got up to make his speech. He spoke very well. He was a persuasive speaker. That day he actually became so intense it was really an outburst, like an outburst in a mental hospital, I would say. It was as if he'd said, "Now you can all do whatever you want." And then, as if every individual in that crowd had been stung by a wasp, all of a sudden they all let themselves go, shouting and stamping and wishing they could tear their arms out. The noise was unbearable. My colleague sat there with her hands clenched. We were both so horrified by what was happening. Not by Goebbels, not just by the people, but by the fact that it was even possible. The two of us weren't part of this crowd. We were onlookers. We were perhaps the only onlookers. It came to the point where I don't think even Goebbels knew what he was saying. I lack the words to describe how he managed to get these hundreds of people to the point where no one was sitting down, but they were all jumping to their feet and shouting and cheering. He did it. I don't think even he knew how. I still remember how we stood there, firmly clutching each other's hands, my little colleague and I. It was as if we were frozen to the spot by everything that was happening. Behind us stood an SS man, and he patted us on the shoulders and said, "At least clap along." So, of course, we clapped along. You had to, of course. He even said so. You couldn't exclude yourself. There was no option. We clapped along. It was as if we were drunk. We both had a sense of something very terrible happening. And then it was over. After they had cheered themselves out. I think that anyone who hadn't cheered along would have been murdered by his neighbors. I don't know. In my whole life, I'd never experienced anything like that. It wasn't enthusiasm. It was as if they didn't know what they were doing. "Do you want total war?" "Yes." The yes was quite unambiguous. The SS man who had brought us drove us home again, and we were both completely horrified by the whole performance. We hadn't grasped what he had been talking about. There was the impression of this clamoring crowd that had no idea why it was clamoring. It was a natural event. The whole crowd could do nothing about it. Goebbels himself probably couldn't either. It seemed to me that he himself didn't understand what he had started. Like a little flame that didn't know what its possibilities were. And then the clamoring crowd. Oh, God. They could just as easily have charged forward and killed him. Until then, we hadn't known that side of Goebbels. We had never gone to any rallies of any kind. So we were quite shaken. It was a complete change. But we probably didn't think much more about it than that. We were bowled over by the moment. Then we somehow came to terms with it. God, we were young, and we didn't think about it so much, not the way we thought about it later, when it was all too late. You weren't even aware of it yourself. While now, when so many years have passed and so much has happened, I see it all quite differently, much more deeply and much stranger. That one person was capable of putting hundreds of people in a state where they were shouting, shouting, shouting. "Yes, we want total war." If you tell somebody that today, they would just shake their head and say,
"Right, were they all drunk or what?"
What was it that made those people shout like that? But they had to. they had really been put under a spell by a single person. I mean, there are psychologists and science that deal with that whole thing about how a thing like that is possible. When I remember that again, I think, how was that possible? That it had such an effect on us. They didn't shout because they had to shout, because somebody had said to them, now go to the rally and then you all have to shout. No, they shouted at that moment because at the front someone was telling them something they agreed with. Like Jesus did, or I don't know. There are things that explain why people en masse do inexplicable things. If they were asked about it, they themselves would be startled. All I can say about Goebbels is that he was an outstanding actor. He was a good actor. Hardly any actor could have given a better performance of the transformation of a well-brought-up, serious person into a crazed brawler than he did. You can certainly say that. He was unrecognizable. That was another thing that left us so shaken by that Sportpalast event. A person you see almost every day in the office, nicely turned out, elegant, almost a noble elegance, and then that raging dwarf. You can hardly imagine a greater contrast. At that moment, I found him terrible. Frightening. But then I repressed it again. I never lionized him or anything like that. Not even later when he came into the office and asked us politely for something. I already had in the back of my head how he had shouted in the Sportpalast. And here you are now playing the part of the elegantly dressed civilian. A short time later, there was an invitation to dinner from Goebbels. The minister had been informed that the ladies in his office sometimes had to spend the night there, because there were no available means of transport after the air raids. A gesture was required. So they said that at some point the minister would invite the secretaries to dinner, but not all at once. Always two at a time to a personal dinner. Two of the secretaries got the ball rolling and the next day came enthusiastically into the office and told the others, "We were collected from the office in a car, of course, and brought to Schwanenwerder, and there was Frau Goebbels and there was fabulous food." No exaggeration. There was a war on, after all. Goebbels always set a good example. He didn't put on anything too luxurious, but everything was lovely and pleasant. It was a terribly nice evening. You can look forward to it when your time comes, they said. It was a few weeks before it was my turn, and I looked forward to it very much. It started exactly like this. A limousine pulled up, and an SS man took us to Wannsee, Schwanenwerder. We went in, and we were led into the dining room. There was a big table laid out, and at least 20 people standing around, Gauleiters or deputy Gauleiters, and I knew some of them from visits or because we'd even dealt with them before. So we weren't alone with Herr Goebbels. Then Goebbels came and greeted us with a handshake, and we sat down. I sat beside him on his right side. I felt very honored. Then we ate. But he didn't say anything to me. He just talked about unimportant matters. The food was nice. I think there was a goose, which in itself was cheering. Then Goebbels sounded off across the table. Sometimes someone else spoke as well, but Herr Minister was the main speaker. He ate quite quickly, and not very much, and so did the others. I had been told beforehand, "Don't put off eating very long. When Goebbels puts his fork or his knife down, then you stop eating, and you don't eat any more. So you have to eat when you're served very quickly, so that you get the benefit of it." I followed that advice. The dinner was over, and then there was pudding. Politics and air raids were the main topics. He only exchanged banalities with me and never asked any personal questions. "How long have you been here?" Or, "Are you married? Do you have relatives? Maybe you have a husband or a father who is at the war." Nothing. He didn't ask me a single personal question. And Frau Goebbels wasn't there at all, which was the big flaw in the evening, because she would have turned it into something jolly and cheerful with a lot of charm. That was missing from the evening. Unfortunately, I had got the wrong day. Then we were led into a side room, and there was this sort of screen there, showing some stupid film that had just come out. We were allowed to watch that, and then we were served something else, a mocha or something. And then the SS man reappeared and drove us back to the city. My colleague and I were very disappointed by that evening. After my release from prison, I was often asked what kind of things crossed our desks. As administrators, we also had to deal with very harmless things. There wasn't really that much work to do. We sat there in the outer office and we made lots of phone calls, all very simple things. The kind that happen in any firm where not everyone knows straight away what's going on. No one at the corporation ever told me, for example, what they were able to listen in on via the London station. They must have had critical things to say. I didn't have friends like that. Perhaps people were a bit cautious with me because I was sitting in Goebbels' office, so they didn't want to tell me anything. But we didn't want to know anyway. We knew it was a terrible war that was served up to us as a necessary war, a war we needed to preserve Germany, which was treated with hostility by the rest of the world. We had no friends abroad either. Our friendships and acquaintances weren't as extensive as that. We were very much limited to ourselves, and even more so as a result of the war. As far as we outer office ladies were concerned, our function was simply to be ready to leap in. We were a cheerful, harmonious gang. We worked well together. We were a nice collection of colleagues, nothing more than that. Our desks were a rectangle. All the reports, requests, and changes produced in the building landed on our desks, but lots of things, probably including the most controversial, had been decided already. Only things that were particularly important reached all the way up to the minister himself, and we got those on our desks. I remember that we weren't allowed to scribble on them. We always had to use blue ink. Not red, not green. Green was the minister, I think. Red was the Secretary of State. I can't remember if those colors are right. But anyway, the colors indicated who the documents were meant for. There are lots of things I can't remember 60 years later. The phone was constantly ringing, but not for Goebbels. He didn't get phone calls directly from his people, from his fellow ministers. He had the latest invention from Siemens, a telephone table, so that you didn't have to dial, you just typed. Then you got straight through to Hermann Göring. But those connections were close to us. We could press the keys as much as we wanted, but nothing happened. Otherwise, we could have called anyone at all, very important people. Of course, much of the work involved embellishing the bare facts from the front or in the Reich. They were corrected on instruction to make things look more positive for us. That was the fundamental principle of public enlightenment. The people were now enlightened when they had previously always been lied to by the other governments. That had been the fundamental principle of the Nazis, but I can't remember any examples today. Otherwise, our days were always exactly the same. Really controversial things like the Scholl case, the White Rose, didn't cross our desks. But Herr Frohwein, Goebbels' personal advisor, handed me all the files, the court files, unsealed. I was to put them in a safe. "Please don't look inside," he said. And I didn't, because my boss asked me not to. Or maybe he said, "I'm relying on you not to peek." It was all very quick, and then he went away. I was left alone with the thing. I didn't look inside. And I thought, oh God, I'd love to. But I won't. He's relying on me not to do it, so I won't do it. I was still very proud because of the trust he put in me. That was more important than satisfying my curiosity. I thought that was very noble of me. I'll never forget that. Towards the end of the war, we kept getting these colored sheets of paper, pink or yellow. They contained the latest truths, not least about figures. Casualty numbers in battles, and about rapes of German women by the approaching Russians. Unimaginable. We passed that on to the corporation and the newspapers. If it said 20 women were raped in the village, we turned it into 30, and so on. Those things were conveyed to the people in an exaggerated version. The terrible crimes of the enemy were all multiplied. I remember that very clearly. The truly important things and some secret orders were always stored in safes. Only the advisers had keys to those. There were lots of things that I couldn't have looked at on the way to the safe, given that it was only a few steps away. The whole thing took only a couple of minutes. I can only vaguely remember which files I held in my hand. Lots from the People's Court. I didn't write a word about them myself or take any dictation about them, and neither did the other ladies. No one knew anything. And we were under obligation. I had to take an oath. When I joined, I'd been given a book about the rules of behavior and also about correct practices. For example, that you couldn't work with a red pen or a green one. Strictly forbidden. You had to know all sorts of things like that. I had to study everything. It was all very strict. It was the only thing we knew. Sometimes we found out when a famous writer had written a letter with a disparaging remark about Hitler or Goebbels. He was arrested and executed straight away. You knew about things like that. Goebbels also wrote his speeches himself and only dictated them to Richard Otte, a very nice man. He took shorthand and was constantly following him around. Goebbels dictated everything to him. A huge article by Goebbels appeared every Sunday. It was just as new to us when it came out on Sunday as it was to everybody else. Otte recorded it. He had a special office and, of course, a secretary. Goebbels dictated it. Then it was sent to the Völkischer Beobachter. That was the main newspaper, and they published it. But we had nothing to do with that either. As I say, we were highly paid shorthand typists and secretaries who could also relax from time to time. But we always had to be there on the dot. And that time, when I was bombed out, people were very generous. You had to run around to an awful lot of offices to do this and that. I was very generously allowed to do all that. One day, something really happened. And to my regret, I wasn't there, because it was my day off. We had days off now and again. I spent mine in Neubabelsberg, near Potsdam, where a colleague of mine lived. At about midday, I suddenly heard something about the attempt on Hitler's life on the radio. I rang the office straight away, the promi, and said, "What's going on? For God's sake, just be glad you didn't come into the office today. We have no idea what's going on. We're just looking out of the window. The whole of Wilhelmsplatz is full of soldiers with rifles. It's not a parade. They're ready to shoot. There's supposed to have been an attempt on the Führer's life. We're all surrounded. No one's allowed to leave the building. We have no idea. We know nothing. And Minister Goebbels isn't here either. We have no idea how we're going to get home. We can't leave." They were totally desperate. Now, I had my ear pressed to the radio, and there were constant reports about it, about everything that was happening. It turned out very quickly that Hitler was still alive. In the promi, they were just scared for their lives when they saw they were surrounded. I was very unhappy not to be there when something was happening. I wasn't glad to be in Potsdam. And then all I know is what everyone knew, the whole story. I found out all about it. And those discussions with the officers in the People's Court, it's all well known. So I just know all of that as an onlooker. We found out other things from day to day. I know that actors sometimes visited Goebbels, but we didn't find out what happened between them. It was about that one film, Jud Süß. There were some films about the historical Jewish question, about 200 years ago. Ferdinand Marian was a very good actor. He had to play that Jew. He played him wonderfully well, and the whole film was great. But he hadn't wanted to play him. He was forced. Then people said, "If you don't play the part, you'll end up in a camp." He resisted, but he had to do it. The film was a great success, but I'm sure he wasn't proud of it. Goebbels was involved in every film that promised to be a great success. Not in every film, but films that were promising had to be shown to him first, and he himself had to make corrections to the cast. I know that. I didn't see it, but you knew. That was his relaxation, his plaything. He probably needed that to counteract all the unpleasant jobs he had to do. He enjoyed that, and he wouldn't let anyone take it away from him. I remember the last big film that Goebbels was involved with. It was already coming to an end. It was deliberately staged in such a way that the people would bear witness to the unconditional will to victory. That was the plan, and in the weekly newsreels, we were always the victors, of course. He re-edited that one furiously. He got very involved in everything, even art. Art, particularly Teutonic art, was fostered a lot even in school, particularly the heroic sagas from the old days. There were also a lot of Austrian films. I can still see many of them in my mind's eye. I even got to meet actors like Attila Hörbiger and Heinrich George, the father of Götz George. He was a great actor. But a lot of Jewish actors got away in time and went to America. We had previously had some good Jewish actors at UFA. good people who all got away in time. I didn't always have the money, particularly when the first films were on, before I started at the corporation. But in those days, that was the chief entertainment because the theater was more expensive. And the opera was quite out of the question. In wartime, of course, culture was very restricted because, first of all, you had to eat. In the meantime, there was radio as well. Radio was an important form of entertainment too, of course. By now, there was only the Reichssender Berlin, especially in the evening at about 11 o'clock. Broadcasts came from the exclusive hotels, Adlon, Excelsior, Kaiserhof and Bristol, Unter den Linden. They were really good hotels and bars, and the bar music was broadcast by the corporation with the latest popular songs. I spent nights on our chaise longue when everyone was in bed asleep. I knew all the songs. I could sing along with everything. Oh, it was wonderful. Sometimes Mama found me when I'd gone to sleep like that. That was lovely. That was all the culture we had. I felt a bit as if I had died inside. I'd often been frightened in my life before, but now I was icy cold, unfeeling. I'm trying to say all my feelings were gone. There wasn't even any room for fear. Just this feeling, it's all over. Nothing more than that. Over. It's all over. Brunhilde Ponsel. Loyal to the end, the last days in the propaganda ministry. Shortly before the downfall, Brunhilde Ponsel made a serious decision that forced her to stay in the air raid shelter of the propaganda ministry next to the Führer's bunker containing the last faithful followers. She only found out in drips and drabs what was happening in the bunker from the last members of Hitler's retinue, who included Hans Fritzsche, one of the senior officials in Goebbels' ministry and a well-known radio commentator, and Goebbels' adjutant, Günther Schwegermann, who burned the bodies of Magda and Josef Goebbels at the end. After Goebbels had refused to surrender, Hans Fritzsche decided to offer to surrender in his own right. Before Fritzsche crossed over to the Soviet side with two of his officials, Brunhilde prepared the white flag for the surrender. After brief negotiations, Fritzsche is supposed to have announced on behalf of the German government that the Soviet side had accepted the surrender. On the evening of May 1, 1945, General Helmut Weidling, commander in the Battle of Berlin, ordered his troops to abandon fighting. I still remember our air raid shelter in the propaganda ministry when Dr. Naumann was over with the Führer in the Führer's bunker. I have a dim memory of an iron plate or something somewhere. That was very much at the end of the war, when they were already flying over the cities in broad daylight. There was a morning raid over Berlin. Not a large raid, but they flew so that you could see the planes, and they were enemy planes. Dr. Naumann sat at his desk and dictated, and I wrote, but I was so frightened I couldn't keep writing. He laughed his head off and said, "Good God, I'll tell you when things get dangerous." At last he stood up quite calmly and said, "Now come with me." And then he walked with me across the square to the door. I remember the planes were no longer in the sky, I think by then they had gone. And suddenly I saw that there was a flight of steps leading down. He left me on my own, shook hands with one of the SS men, then led me back to the ministry. I'd never seen that before. And later, when I was among the people again, I heard about it. The Führer had a bunker under Wilhelmsplatz. I'd never heard of it before. I was very scared during the war. I remember that, when there were air raids and some women, mostly hysterical women, said, "Oh, if only a bomb would hit us and everything would be over." Then I could shout, "No, no, we need to live. I want to live. I don't want to be killed by a bomb." I had an incredible will to live. I have no idea what for. I wanted to stay alive. I didn't want to be killed by the war. At the end of the war, we spent almost all our time sitting in that horrible cellar in the propaganda ministry, still believing in that stupid Wenck army, which would move round the back of the invading Russians and attack them from behind, and then the decision would have been made and the war won for us. When we went into the cellar in April, a day after Hitler's birthday, I still believed in it. but then no one talked to anyone anymore. But we believed all of that and felt safe. We were informed about some of the things that went on in the Führer's bunker. Someone always appeared to tell us what was happening. Once Herr Naumann came, I remember that. He was checking to see if we had anything to eat. I remember eating asparagus by the pound in those days, raw, out of tins, tinned asparagus. Someone else often came, but I can't remember his name anymore. Goebbels' adjutant, Herr Schwegermann, appeared one day, Günther Schwegermann, a fine man, a nice man, and he delivered a bit of a report. He told us that Goebbels was with his family in the Führer's bunker. And the children? The children, too, the whole family, they're living in the bunker now. Well, now we had a clearer idea. The nice flat near the Brandenburg Gate was too dangerous, and the Russians were no longer just bombing from the air. They were already firing rocket launchers. That was why he had taken his family to the bunker. In our first few days in the bunker, a telephone was still working. I remember that we phoned Hamburg. You could still do that from Berlin. Afterwards, it all went dead. We just sat there and looked around the cellar to see what we could find. There was plenty of wine, but we needed something to eat as well. We found preserves and we ate those. You couldn't go outside and fetch something back. You couldn't stick your head out of the shelter at all. Then people who had been wounded by the Russians in street battles were brought to us in the cellar. So there was just a very small gang of us waiting. We were slowly coming to understand that the thing about the Wenck army, which was supposed to come and liberate us, was probably not quite correct. We had two large rooms, some of which were equipped with camp beds. Someone could sleep on one of those for 4 hours. Then he would have to get up and make room for someone else. It went on like that for a good week. We were always aware when orderlies came to the building and brought in more patients. There were noises of some kind, so we closed the doors and locked ourselves away a little. What else were we supposed to do? Oh, God, we vegetated. We knew that something had to happen. Every now and again, someone came over from the Führer's bunker because Neumann was over there, and the SS soldiers kept us up to date with what was going on. So there I was in the cellar, and then Schwegermann came in and said, "Hitler's taken his own life." For the first time, we were all exposed, standing there. No one said anything. Everyone had their own thoughts on that matter. And then he disappeared again. He only wanted to tell us because he knew we had no idea what was going on in the Führer's bunker. That was the first thing we learned. Everyone knew what it meant. The war was over and lost. The war was over. That was clear to all of us. I can't remember how we found out the details. I think there was a whole day and a whole night in between. In my memory, there's a long time in between, at least a day and a night. Then Schwegermann came again and said, "Goebbels has taken his own life, and his wife too. And the children? The children too." After that, there was nothing more we could say. Oh God, that certainly wasn't nice. We probably tried to make sure that the alcohol didn't run out. We needed it urgently. Maybe not everyone, but certainly people were tippling a lot there. You had to numb yourself. We had no work to do, and the mood? There was fear, but there was also a sense of not being able to change anything. There was also a certain apathy. Now the time had come. We didn't know what had come exactly, but it was all over. I didn't even think, will they shoot me now, or will the Russians rape me? None of that mattered. I felt a bit as if I had died inside. I'd often been frightened in my life before, but now I was icy cold, unfeeling. I'm trying to say all my feelings were gone. There wasn't even any room for fear. Just this feeling, it's all over. Nothing more than that. Over. It's all over. There's one other thing I remember about the previous few days. It was the last day when we still had our typewriters on the terrace at Goebbels' house. Dr. Kollatz came, another of Dr. Goebbels' personal advisers, a very nice man, and he said, "Pomseline, my wife and daughter are still in Potsdam, and I want to say goodbye to them before things get any worse here. I've organized a motorbike, There was a transport department, part of the ministry, and there were motorbikes as well. You weren't allowed to ride them by then. And you couldn't, because there was no petrol. But Dr. Kollatz had managed to borrow a motorbike with petrol for his journey to Potsdam. And then he said, I remember you told me your parents were now in a house in Potsdam. Our flat was uninhabitable again. Everything was broken, all the windows, all the doors, because of bombs that had fallen nearby. I can take you along, he said. I'm setting off tomorrow morning, and then coming back. We can do a quick trip. Yes, I said. I'd love to come with you to see my parents again. With me on the pillion, he drove there, said goodbye, and said, I'll come back at 7 in the evening and collect you again. I spent the whole afternoon with my parents, lunchtime and afternoon. Then it was 7 o'clock, and Dr. Kollatz didn't come. Then it was 8. Then 9. I had no idea how to contact him. Of course, my parents were still awake as well, but then eventually Mama said, it's time to go to bed. We woke up at 7 the next morning. Dr. Kollatz hadn't come. Now I was very agitated because in those days there were lots of people who suddenly didn't turn up for work, who didn't care about anything and who were suddenly gone. There were lots of people who got wind of what was coming and fled. But I had a job to do and I was part of the team. I had to go into the city. I had to go back. My mother said, so must you really? Yes, I must. I was very dutiful. I was extremely important. I went to the station, which was ridiculous. There were no actual rail connections anymore, but in fact a train did come, a local train heading for Friedrichstrasse station. I don't know why it came. It stopped and picked me up. There were other people in it. Essentially, during those days, everything had collapsed. I went from Friedrichstrasse station straight to the propaganda ministry and into the cellar, and then I was in there for about another 10 or 11 days. Somebody later told me what had happened to Dr. Kollatz. He went to see his wife. He had a little daughter of about 10 or 11, a disabled child, but her parents were very attached to her. She was their only child. He rode there, took them both to the Wannsee, and shot his wife and child and himself. He extinguished all three lives. So he had never planned to come back. But neither could he tell me what he had planned, and he couldn't say to me that he wasn't coming back. He went there with very firm intentions and did it deliberately, because he thought he had no more prospects in his life. Did Dr. Kollatz want to save my life? Certainly. He must have thought, if she's worked it out somehow, she will use the opportunity to stay in the country. In retrospect, that was enormously stupid of me. It really was a time when you knew that the war couldn't be won. Why did I have to go back? It was stupid of me. But I hadn't thought about what would happen next. I think by that point I couldn't feel anything. It was as if I was dead, pale and extinguished. It's hard for me to talk about things in the past and what state of mind I was in. Now, of course, I'm glad that I always coped with things well. It could have been quite different, but then I wouldn't have had the chance to think about it, and it would all have been over for me as well. Today, I think that for all the things that happened to me, I mean things that weren't good, particularly bad things, well, I dealt with them reasonably well. I'm glad about that, and I'm also content with myself, and I have every reason to be. Everything was nice, so much of the time. In between times, I was very, very happy. It was never actually completely boring, but sometimes it was a bit boring. My God, a life like that can't just consist of highs and lows. There were long periods of resting in between. I had those, but so does everybody. There was no miracle weapon and no Wenck army to come and save us. We stopped thinking, full stop. We put our hands in our laps and thought, how's it going to end? There were a few real idiots, I was one of them, who thought the Wenck army, the one that was going to attack the Russians from behind, would make it, and that would be the climax of the war, Now the Venk army is killing the Russian soldiers and we've come up smiling. There weren't very many of us in the hardcore of the propaganda ministry. I didn't believe it by pure faith. I just thought there was no other possibility, just that one. The army exists, it will come and make a clean sweep and then everything will be fine. The Venk army wandered through our brains like ghosts until the very last days. Eventually, we all worked out that the wool had been pulled over our eyes. Some people worked it out a bit earlier than that. I was so stupid. I went on believing it practically until the last day, because I really couldn't imagine anything else. We couldn't lose the war after all. Why not? No, we couldn't. That was the right tactic to take them from behind. We had no idea that the Russians were already in Germany. I was such an idiot back then. If, in that difficult time, when so much had to be thought through and overcome, if you got into a conflict about having done everything wrong, you didn't even want to admit it to yourself. I think I've done a lot of things wrong in my life, and back then I didn't think about it. I belonged there. I was always very dutiful. You could rely on my work. That worked. That was right. And when I had a task, I had to fulfill it. It's been like that my whole life, even then, whether the work was good or bad. That wasn't the main thing, whether I was working at the corporation or in the propaganda ministry. It was all the same stuff. It didn't make any difference. Back then, you were just thinking, phew, I'm still alive. Even if everything at home was broken, you're still alive. Oh, the windows are broken again, the doors won't shut, but you're still alive. That was the thinking of thousands of people who lived with it every day. It was nothing. It was part of things like breathing. At any rate, we were sitting there in that bunker like rats, and the Russians were in Berlin. Suddenly, two people from the corporation building on Masurenallee turned up, people I knew. One of them was Hanne Sobeck. He was a footballer. Before football became as important as it is today. He was one of the really brilliant footballers, and he was given a job in the sport department at the corporation. He and somebody else came on foot and said that the Russians were already in Masurenallee. We were still sitting in the cellar. There was no phone. We no longer had a connection to the outside world, and we were sitting in the cellar like trapped mice. We still had one of the most senior members of staff with us. That was Hans Fritzsche, and some of the advisers from the propaganda ministry were there as well. Hans Fritzsche was Berlin's deputy Gauleiter, and in that capacity, Herr Fritzsche was Goebbels' deputy. He was mostly busy with the other advisers, but then Herr Fritzsche gave us a task to do. We had to empty food sacks of flour and rice and noodles. They were separated out or cut open, and we had to stitch together a huge white flag. We had nothing to stitch them with, but somehow we did it and made a flag. We also noticed that it had slowly become quieter in Berlin, and if you heard shots, you noticed that they were rifle shots and not artillery shelling like before. It was small arms fire. At any rate, we stitched together that big flag somehow, and Fritzsche, with two men beside him, said he would go, even though there was still constant shooting outside, and try to get down Bendlerstraße to talk to the Russians. He set off with some other people, leaving us alone, but he said, "Stay here. I'll look after you. We're taking the white flag to Bendlerstraße." That was where the Russians had their military high command. When they'd been away for hours, a Russian crowd forced their way in. We were really a poor rabble and had no leaders anymore. Herr Fritzsche, who we all liked a lot and valued, had left us in the lurch, so we really sat there like lambs to the slaughter. We were waiting for the Russians, and suddenly there they were. A squad of maybe 5 or 6 Russian soldiers. Mostly they had Mongolian faces, totally alien faces, and of course they had their rifles on their shoulders. They were scared themselves, forcing their way into a house like that when there were so many corridors and so on. They were prepared to be attacked in one way or another. They crept down the corridor and then pushed the door open. There were about 10 of us. They drove us together and wanted to lead us out, force us out. We were already out of our underground hole, and then I heard another shot. Someone said, "That was Meyer." We were driven out to the exit onto Mauerstraße, which was the rear exit of the propaganda ministry. We were back in daylight for the first time in 10 days. We were all green in the face, and all looked terrible. They were pushing us somewhere with their rifles, and I'm sure we thought it was all over. Then suddenly a squad came towards us from Mauerstraße, with a white flag, a torn but still recognizable as a flag. I can't remember if Fritsche was still with them, but one of the men who had gone with him was there. He might even have been there himself. At any rate, there were Russian officers at their head. We were pushed back into the bunker. We couldn't ask any questions. We were chess pieces being pushed back and forth. There we sat again, and Fritsche wasn't there anymore. Russian soldiers came, but they looked quite different this time. Stylish, with good suits. They came from military command, from Chukov, that was his name, the supreme commander in Berlin. After Fritsche had seen him and agreed the surrender of the city of Berlin, he took charge of us, and these soldiers that he was sending now belonged to the elite. They dragged us out again and took us on foot from the city center to Tempelhof. Suddenly everything was deadly silent in Berlin, with just the sound of trotting horses. I only heard and saw a few car horns and trucks, but no more shooting. The city was still full of corpses that hadn't yet been cleared away. We weren't aware of anything anymore. Russian women in uniforms had even been deployed to control the traffic. We had to stop at a corner, and there was an elderly German couple there. They stood with us and looked at how we were surrounded by the soldiers and asked, "Have you been taken prisoner or what?" We said, "We don't know yet." And then the Russians started going, "Davai, davai," again, and pushed us on and the other couple with us. The Russians wanted to get away quickly, so they simply pushed them into our group. Near Tempelhof, they pushed us into a little flat, a 2-room flat. There must have been 10 of us. So that's where we sat, and we spent a night there. There was nothing to eat, nothing to drink, nothing. That elderly couple was still with us, and they cried when they found out who they'd been thrown together with. They were in complete despair. There were a few Russians who spoke a bit of German, and we did all we could to make it clear to the Russians that this couple were complete strangers and had nothing to do with us, that they just wanted to cross the road at the corner and had been taken along by mistake. They actually let them go free. They believed us. But then they wouldn't leave me alone. And the lady I was initially locked up with was a white Russian. Her parents had fled Russia in 1918 after the Great Revolution. There were a lot of white Russians living in Berlin, and for the Russians, they were even worse than the Nazis because they were actually traitors. Her husband was a journalist, and they'd picked up her husband as well somewhere. They were constantly being called in for questioning, and the poor woman was badly tortured. When I was arrested by the Russians, I thought, the war's over now. Now things will somehow get back to normal. The Russians who questioned me were also quite friendly. They were interpreters with good German. They were nice, I thought. They'll let me go home now. So I was still quite confident. When we were all sitting there in the room, and due to be questioned, we discussed it all amongst ourselves. "We'll just say we were going from one place to another and had just taken refuge from the shooting in the propaganda ministry." Others said, "No, no contradictions. One person saying one thing, another saying a different thing." I thought to myself, I'll tell the truth. I'll say I worked there, of course only doing shorthand for that dreadful Dr. Goebbels. I never saw him because it's a big building after all, and I was far too unimportant. I never saw him, but I did work there. Before that, I worked at the Broadcasting Corporation and was then compulsorily transferred to the propaganda ministry, which was true. But then I never saw him. It was all in my files at the time, because I thought that if I was questioned and then questioned again, we've read about things like that, then you slip up and they'll catch you lying. But as long as I always tell the truth, I know I can stand by it and it won't be anything serious. They couldn't punish me for that. Anyway, I didn't think about suicide or being shot. They'll just let me go home. That's what I thought. I didn't do anything because it came out that they knew. They didn't say, "Now we'll keep you here." They said, "Thank you," and led me away again. And they didn't release me for 5 years. Evil exists. The devil exists. God doesn't exist. But there is no justice. Justice doesn't exist. Brunhilde Pomsel. We knew nothing. Arrest and new beginning. After her arrest, Brunhilde Pomsel ended up in Soviet Special Camp No. 2, which was set up in August 1945 on the site of the former Buchenwald concentration camp. The Soviet camp was organized on the order of the People's Commission for Internal Affairs, Lavrenti Beria, and was almost completely isolated and used primarily for the internment of National Socialists and war criminals. Prisoners had no contact with their families and were otherwise cut off from any information from the outside world. Many prisoners died in the camp from illness and malnutrition. Rejecting personal guilt in her retrospective analysis, Pomsel delivers her judgment on Joseph Goebbels and the regime. If I had listened to Dr. Kollatz, I wouldn't have ended up in that concentration camp and been dragged by the Russians from one camp to another. I should certainly have left Berlin. Our flat was wrecked, so I couldn't stay there. And now that was my fate. Who is in control of his fate in such agitated times? Very few people can say, I did this and this for that and that reason. It just happens to us. But now I had the bad luck to be picked up. If I had been in my wrecked flat, then I wouldn't have been in the ministry. Then the Russians wouldn't have come and found me. If I'd stayed at home, nothing at all might have happened. Of course, you've thought about whether there was something you could have done against the Nazis. It wasn't possible. Or it would have meant putting your life on the line. You had to expect the worst, and there were enough examples of that. It was all a huge crime. Everyone was clear about that afterwards. But at the time, we were so wrapped in propaganda and we slipped into it. There was a large portion of stupidity involved as well. But part of it was that you had no connections. Who had any connections abroad in those days? Nobody. And the few who tried to make a stand, what good did it do? None of them are alive anymore. Many people hoped for something quite different from the state, and on recommendations they joined the party and wanted to take part. The only people with a truly strong will to join the party with intent and conviction were primarily the ones who were members of the SS and, of course, the SA. But maybe not so much. The SA were more for the common people. The SS were to be treated with considerable caution. However, I found myself in the political cauldron. I was still an outsider. I don't think about it. I don't know how it could have been prevented either. There will always be idiots who follow the wrong people and pay dearly for it. In fact, I can't imagine it happening again. But whether people learned from it, I don't know. After the end of the First World War, Germany was leaderless. There were no personalities there, and that was why it was so easy for Hitler. Too many unemployed, and they were his whole support. Now we have a completely different form of government, a different way of life. No, I don't think a thing like that will happen again. It wouldn't be possible now. Of course, National Socialism could have been prevented, but in those days there were only extremes facing one another. The strong opposition between communism and nationalism. This isn't so marked today. It was only after my release that I found out what had happened. Other people in Germany had been slowly informed about things. After the end of the war and the Nuremberg trials, they learned about all the things that had happened during that time. It's just as bad when you find out slowly a little bit every day. You get used to it. When I found out about those things in the camp, about those images, those mass graves, I woke up to it. But it still wasn't our fault. If we didn't know about it. And it would never be my fault either, no. I myself was imprisoned in Buchenwald and Sachsenhausen and in a factory in East Berlin, which is occupied by the Russians, so I was never in a Russian prison. And even where I was, we didn't learn anything about the things that had happened. We were isolated. Where Goebbels was concerned, I only really understood the kind of people Goebbels and his wife must have been right at the end. They could have fled. Above all, I wonder why they had to kill themselves, and particularly the children. Yes, the Russians were there, but Hannah Reich had offered to fly them out. Supposedly they could have landed her little plane to fly out the children. It's the attitude of the mother that I really don't understand. They also say, I don't remember, I heard it somewhere or other, that the eldest girl furiously resisted taking that pill. I think they were given a sleeping pill beforehand. The child is supposed to have known or guessed what was happening and fought back. It's unimaginable. Goebbels taking his own life, fine. He had no other option, but everything else is cowardice. Bringing the children into it, inexcusable. The children would have lived and become their own people. No, that's so brutal. A mother being able to kill the children she brought into the world, and such premeditated murder. There are sometimes excuses for spontaneous murder, but it's definitely as great a crime as the whole war. So people who caused this whole drama, who then made off like that and shifted responsibility to the next in line, they are craven cowards as far as I'm concerned. They swallow one of those pills and they're gone. Göring bites the pill, gone. The others have to face the music. But the one who was ultimately responsible was right at the top. Hitler. I'd known for some time that there were concentration camps. But that people were gassed and burned in them, never. If I imagine standing under something like that in Buchenwald, when we were led to the showers, you had to take off your clothes and hang them on a hook. Mine was hook number 47. And while I was showering, my clothes were cleaned and then hung in another room on a hook with the same number, so that I could find them again. Meanwhile, I stood for a quarter of an hour in a big tiled room where there were big showers placed at regular intervals. The water came out and you stood under it and it bubbled out nicely. You got a little bit of soap so that you could wash yourself and everything. The shower was warm for a really long time until it turned cold. And then out you went into that other warm room. It was always nice and warm. Then you got dressed and left again. Afterwards, I felt ill at the idea that in the same place, which we always looked forward to because we had warm water on our skin again at last, that these things were used to pump out gas to kill the Jews. I don't know exactly how they did it, but that's how they killed them. But I felt I was being treated very badly and very wrongly, that I, of all people, should have been taken away by the Russians, because all I had done was type in Herr Goebbels' office. No, so I can't bring myself to feel a sense of guilt. I'm guilty if I do something. All I did was have the bad luck not to be at home on the day when the Russians went to the propaganda ministry. But of course I'm guilty in the sense of being stupid. But it wasn't what everybody wanted. They promised themselves a new revival after the loss of the First World War, and at first that actually happened. A re-blossoming of a humiliated people who had lost the war and not gained some of the rights that could have grown out of the treaty. The people who knew most about the atrocities were the ones who were in direct contact with the institutions and the prisons, and they didn't speak out for fear that they themselves might have to pay the price. They weren't even always party members. Many of them were simple, plain, perhaps slightly stupid, at least politically stupid people who didn't think about it at all very much. I wasn't one of them. I would have had to know a lot more than I did. It was more or less out of thoughtlessness that I joined that stupid party that most people were in, but then imprisonment turned out to be a mixed blessing. At first, I was terribly afraid when the Russians had crossed the German border. Afraid of what they were doing to German women. All of that was unthinkable for us. But it didn't happen. And no one at the time knew where we were all headed. But after the war, most people didn't know what they were going to live on. The companies that paid their wages had gone bust. Money no longer had any value. I just remember that in the summer of 1945, we sat outside the barracks in the former Buchenwald concentration camp. We didn't have to work. We just sat around and talked about home and what it would be like, how things would go on. I remember one saying, "At least with the Russians, we get our pearl barley soup morning, noon, and evening. Who knows whether our people at home always get enough to eat?" We had no information about how other people in Germany were faring. We went through ups and downs as well. Even in Buchenwald, I had lovely moments that I will never forget. I stood on the stage in a primitive little play written by an inmate and encouraged by a very nice Russian captain who unfortunately stopped being camp commandant after that. He was replaced, although by a very nice man